So, we sketched the inverse scattering theory for Schrödinger in 1D as motivation for what we'll do in 2D. In 1D, one constructs solutions phi with this ansatz, and we find that mu far away has these asymptotics. So at minus infinity, we see the we send in the e to the ikx from minus infinity. And what comes back is the reflection coefficient r of k times e to the minus ikx. And over there, what goes through, so this is called the transmission coefficient. Is this fraction of e to the ikx. So this is scattering data which we see far away. Now, looking at the Gelfand-Levitan-Marchenko business, we were led to Koifman's observation that, So this is what we called, mu plus, right? And we defined the mu, which was mu plus for, so mu plus extends to an analytic function in the upper half plane. Upper half complex plane, mu minus lower half. And we calculated the ddk bar derivative of this function with a jump. Since it's analytic in the upper half complex plane, d bar is 0 here, it's 0 there, and all we pick up is a delta function on the real line times the reflection coefficient. So it's this discovery that the reflection coefficient shows up not only in the far x asymptotics, but also in the departure of this from being analytic, in the ddk bar derivative. And once we have that from the Cauchy-Green formula, we have this, since mu goes to 1 at infinity. Therefore, if we substitute this calculation of the mu dk bar, we get essentially an integral equation for mu given r. So the inverse problem consists in solving this linear integral equation in mu. And then I showed you how once you have mu, you get q. Now, in 2D, we spent quite a bit of effort constructing solutions of this equation, which have this form. So that with mu minus 1 in, if you remember, W1 P tilde, Q is in LP. And so last time, we calculated the asymptotics of the solutions we got for large set. So this is lower order as z goes to infinity. And so that's supposed to be analogous to this. We're asking, what does mu look like far away? And the answer is given in terms of two functions. You know what? This thing doesn't look like mu. This looks more like phi. So, mu looks like this far away, where one quote scattering data comes out to be the integral of Q mu. That's a little bit analogous to the transmission coefficient in that we will not need it to in the reconstruction. And that then this oscillating term times something I called T. So T is our scattering transform, and I showed you that the linear part of T is essentially the Fourier transform of Q. I mean, you can just see that because mu is 1 plus terms in Q. Therefore, the linear part of T is just what we called Fourier transform at K. This is just notation. Integral of EK something is Fourier transform of minus 2KR to KI. So that motivates us to define our T. We've done that. Now the issue is, how are we going to, so the question is, how do we go from T to Q? Later, we'll see that we can go from lambda Q to T. Okay? So the plan of how we're going to solve the inverse problem of going from the Dirichlet to Neumann map to Q is to first recover this scattering transform of Q from lambda and then do an inversion going from T to Q. So today we'll start on that step. And to start on that step, inspired by the 1D business, we're going to try to calculate T mu dk bar. So we'd like to calculate D mu dk bar. Yeah, same thing. We're identifying Z and X. We're identifying Z and X. Z is X1 plus IX2. We're identifying R2 and C. But here X will become a parameter, and we're now interested in the behavior in K. So let me tell you the theorem, and then we'll see how far we can go in proving this. So first, before I talk about the theorem, I have to talk about weighted LP spaces. So we're going to define LP alpha to equal, oh, so first of all, here's notation, X is the square root of 1 plus X squared. So it's sort of a smoothed out norm of X. So the reason we're introducing this is we don't want to worry about what happens when X is 0. And LP alpha is going to be the set of F such that X to the alpha F is an LP, with the LP alpha norm of F is simply the LP norm of X alpha F. So in fact, these spaces are not that foreign. In fact, note F or G is in let's say HS, the Sobolev space, if and only if G hat is in L2S. Right? Because the Sobolev space consists of things that are 1 plus xi squared to the S G hat xi squared dxi finite. And that's the same as xi to the 2s, xi to the s times g squared. Now, why do we study weighted spaces? So a general idea for analysis in unbounded domains so by analysis I mean analysis of partial differential equations. Operators in unbounded domains. So somehow you need some condition at infinity. You need to know how things grow. To recover, for instance, compactness properties of Green's functions, so when you're in a bounded domain, it's compact, and compactness helps a lot. When you're in unbounded domains, if you want to somehow recover compactness properties So working in weighted LP or Sobolev spaces, is often useful. So that's the general idea. I should say, we'll say W S P alpha will consist of F such that X alpha F is in W S P. So you can extend this to Sobolev spaces, and notice that this we've taken care to make infinitely smooth, so this doesn't affect smoothness, it only affects behavior at infinity. I should say here also that warning, different authors have different, may have different conventions on the weights. So when you read papers, make sure you're clear about what they mean by when they have a weighted space. So for instance, here you could have an alpha over P, you could have an alpha over P minus N. I mean, but it's just a different meaning of what alpha is. Okay. So with those preliminaries, and I will show you why I need weighted spaces in a moment. With those preliminaries, I can now state my theorem. Theorem let Q be real valued and in LP row of R2, P as before is between 1 and 2, and rho is a weight bigger than 1. Now, I'll make here a remark. For our inverse boundary value problem, Q we defined, so on, so this is in omega, we define Q identically zero outside omega. So decay at infinity is not a problem, not an issue. However, for other questions, I wanted to not restrict Q to have compact support and found that I couldn't quite prove the D-bar equation for Q in LP. But needed a bit more decay. Then, for any k complex non-zero, which is not exceptional, I'll come back to what exceptional means. Did I tell you what exceptional means? Okay. All right, so we have not an exceptional point. We have d mu dk bar equals 1 over 4 pi k bar p of k e to the minus xk or kx mu of xk bar. Where t is as before, where t is the scattering transform. And then the issue is, in what sense is this true? And it's true in the Sobolev W1p tilde minus beta topology. Or beta bigger than 2 over p tilde. So remember, p tilde is 1 over p minus a half. And so this is true in that weighted space. So in a moment, I'll come back to the issue with exceptional points. What is question? That's right. Right. Yes, we're going to solve this. So the point is, if you give me t, this is the definition of t. But if you give me t, this is a linear equation for mu. Now, in the forward problem, t is some object associated to q. So for every potential q, we associate its, quote, nonlinear Fourier transform t. Okay? Now you may ask me, what on earth do you mean by this? Well, I define t as follows. Construct, so if you give me q, this is how I define its transform. I solve the Schrödinger equation the way we did for several lectures. I find the mu, when I find the mu, I calculate this integral, and that gives me a function of k, and I call that the scattering transform of q. So it's some function of k. No, this theorem doesn't say anything about reconstruction. It's a derivative theorem. It's an identity about d mu dk bar. We will later have a theorem that for functions t in a certain class, we can solve this equation for mu. We're not there yet. So, in the inverse problem, we start with the Dirichlet-Neumann map. We will calculate this function t. Right? As far as we know, there may or may not be a mu in here. This is some function of k, which we will have a method to calculate out of this. In fact, by solving linear integral equations. Once we have this function k, we're going to show that there's a unique mu satisfying this equation. Again, q is not in sight here. I give you t, as you say, and I will show there's a unique mu that satisfies. So the wonderful thing is how nice the analogy to 1D can be pushed through. We have this T, which appeared for us in the calculation of, right? So you start from Q, you find a mu. What does it look like for large X? Right? When we constructed this, right, we had no idea what it would look like for large x, other than that it's 1. But what comes after that? What's the next term in the asymptotics? Well, it turns out this gadget appears. So T is in some sense the analog, let's say, of the reflection coefficient. And now what I'm saying is T also shows up if you take this function mu and you differentiate it with respect to k bar. It didn't have to do that, but it does. That's what this will prove. Okay, so I'll leave the executive summary here for Sarah. okay, so it turns out just proving share with us. What? T? Well, no, here's how I understand that. The way I understand that is that if you remember, we start with minus Laplacian plus q for psi. We substitute psi as e to the I kz mu. And then the equation for mu is minus Laplacian. I always forget what this is. Is it 4 IKD bar. Plus Q mu is 0. So K appears analytically in here. There's no K bar. Therefore, I can differentiate this with respect to K. Bar, sorry, with respect to K bar. And so I expect the mu dk bar to also be a solution of the same equation. If I've constructed enough solutions, if these mu's are in some sense a basis, then this d mu dk bar should be expressible as, quote, a linear combination of the mu's. And so it turns out that the coefficient in that linear combination, so in fact, in higher dimensions, this is an integral. There are lots of mu's, and you're integrating over some parameters. Here it just happens that the coefficient in front of that mu, we can calculate explicitly, and it also happens that it's what shows up in the large Z asymptotics. All right. Now, proving this theorem takes a while. There are some technical difficulties which you can foresee from this little statement here. Oh, by the way, K exceptional. So let's just say remark. We say K is an exceptional point. If the operator I plus MKQ which takes W1 P tilde to itself which we used in the construction of mu. Is not invertible. Now you may say, wait a second, didn't I prove to you that it's invertible for every K? We proved that if Q comes from the conductivity equation, from a conductivity equation. Conductivity equation. I.e. Q Laplace psi naught over psi naught for some psi naught bounded. Then there are no exceptional points. but I don't need that here. So again, the issue of exceptional points is not an issue in for us. But in this particular differentiation theorem, I don't need that. I'm just saying if k is a complex number for which this is invertible, and therefore you can define mu at that k, that's also true nearby, and d mu k, d mu dk bar will satisfy that equation. Now, why do I bother with this generalization? Because it will help me prove the converse of this, that if there are no exceptional points, then Q must be of that form. We may or may not discuss this in this course, but that plays a role here. Okay. So, what I'm going to do is first try to give you the formal calculation, and then we'll see how much of the rigorous proof of this theorem will do. So the formal calculation of d mu dk bar. So recall mk we defined as, well, it's the inverse of the conjugated Laplacian, and we defined it as minus 1 over 4 ik d bar inverse minus d plus ik inverse d bar inverse. With d plus ik inverse, was e minus k d inverse ek. So mu is the solution of an integral equation. Mu is solves the integral equation 1 minus mkq mu. And so d mu dk bar will be minus dmk dk bar applied to q mu minus mk q d mu dk bar. So the idea is we'll calculate dmk dk bar, that's an operator, and then solve, I guess that's my start equation for the day, solve star explicitly. Mu dk bar. So I think of star as an integral equation for d mu dk bar, assuming that you know mu. And so I will be able to solve it explicitly, believe it or not, and the answer will come out to be that. And so to begin with, let's start small. So to begin with, we need, let's calculate. ddk bar of d plus ik inverse. Well, at first you might say, wait a second, isn't this analytic in K? People have made that mistake to think that this should be zero. If you look on the Fourier transform side, right, this is multiplication by something like xi1 minus ixi2 plus ik. So that's the kernel of that operator. And this is not analytic in k. This has a pole when k is I times. And so ddk bar will pick up a delta function at that pole. But that's not how we'll do it. We will do it directly. So d plus ik inverse of f at z is e minus kz. D inverse EKF, which is 1 over, so it's E minus KZ, 1 over pi integral, convolution by Z bar minus W bar, EKW, F of W, D to W. W is in C. So we can bring everything with a k in here, ek of w minus z, z bar minus w bar, f of w, d to w. So ddk bar of d plus ik inverse f at z equals, I lost the pi. Well, ddk bar of this exponential, where's the exponential? It's gone, but ekz is just e to the I kz plus k bar z bar. So this is analytic in k, and I'm just left with an I w bar minus z bar minus w bar, ek w minus z, f of w, d to w. So this is minus I over pi, e minus kz, times EKW FW D2W. So this is minus I over pi b minus kz times what I call the Fourier transform of the f at k. So if you think about it, a delta of k minus something like that gives you the same thing. It means you have to take c equals k, basically, and you get this. Well, that's how I first did it with Ablowitz, but this is okay, so we have a very nice calculation of d plus ik inverse. It becomes basically the Fourier transform of f and k. And as a function of position, it's just e minus kz. Now, recall, we had d plus ik inverse defined as an operator from LP to LP tilde. So you might say, well, maybe ddk bar should also be an operator from here to there. And you see right away that it can't be, because the dependence in x is just that, and that's simply not, it's bounded, it's not decaying, it's not in LP tilde. So we need to put it in some other space, and that was my motivation for introducing the weighted LP spaces. So at least I'm going to do this part rigorously in the next hour to see how we use the weights. And in the third hour, or maybe even starting the first, I'd like to tell you about estimates for this in weighted spaces, which are basically the Nirenberg-Walker estimates. So those are new estimates on D inverse, which we haven't discussed yet. So I'm going to have a little proposition. Which will make this calculation at least ddk bar of d plus ik inverse rigorous while you're awake. And then as you tire out, I'll go back to more formal calculations of this. So before the proposition, as usual, some motivation. So I should say that once this observation of Koifman's about d bar came in to the inverse scattering business, it became very, very popular. As I mentioned last time, it provided two directions that somehow freed up things. One is that to define scattering data, you didn't need to look at large x asymptotics anymore. You could just do the ddk bar derivative, right? So you could consider the calculation we had, which I just erased over here, the large X calculation, as just motivation for the T. But in fact, for the proof, this is enough. Right? The fact that mu far in large X looks like T does not enter into the uniqueness proof. So that frees us from tricky large X behavior. It also frees us from having families of analytic functions in K. So up to that point, people were doing Riemann-Hilbert problems with functions which are analytic in different sections of the plane. Well, in this particular problem, typically mu is not analytic anywhere. It turns out it doesn't matter as long as we have a calculation of the mu dk bar. From this, I think that's tricky. It's one of the tricky businesses. It should be gettable, right? Because once you have T, you should be able to determine mu, and therefore the large X asymptotics are in there. But showing that is not obvious. So, to continue my thought, in the inverse scattering business, much of it is formal, and you can find hundreds of papers with D bar. At various equations, in fact, playing the D-bar game to try to find integrable nonlinear equations and so forth. I couldn't find any paper where this was actually rigorously proved, that ddk bar is what it should be as given by the formal calculation. So that's why I want to show you this. So the motivation is the following. First of all, E minus KZ is 1. We'd like to connect with our earlier estimate LP to LP, p tilde, which in turn was motivated by by the desire to allow Q in LP and so how do we reconcile the fact that we want to be in L infinity, but we want to play with LP spaces? And so so we look for, space LP tilde, let's call it minus beta, such that if you're in L infinity, you're in that space. Okay, so I'm going to work in a larger space than L infinity as my target space. So what does that mean? So if G is in LP tilde minus beta, if and only if x to the minus beta g is in LP tilde, so it's trivial. If you take g p tilde x to the minus beta p tilde, and you want that finite for G bounded, that's G L infinity times the integral x to the minus beta p tilde to the 1 over p tilde. And this is finite provided right, think of polar coordinates in R2. This is all R2. Polar coordinates in R2 the only problem is at infinity. At infinity this is 1 over R or rho to the beta p tilde rho d rho. Okay, so you need beta p tilde minus 1 to be bigger than 1, beta p tilde bigger than 2, which means beta bigger than 2 over p tilde. So recall that p is between 1 and 2. That puts p tilde bigger than 2. So 2 over p tilde is less than 1. So this beta is not so horrible. It's actually a number less than 1, or can be chosen less than 1. Okay? And that's where this condition, beta bigger than 2 over p tilde, comes. So that's half the motivation. The other part of the motivation is, maybe I'll put it over here. Since I want to do this pointwise for every k, right? Because k may or may not be an exceptional point, so I want to stay local in k. For a pointwise result in K, need this defined at every K, the Fourier transform. So would like F to be in L1. So locally, so this is my target space. Locally, LP functions are in L1. What's wrong with them? Why aren't they in L1 globally? Well, they don't decay fast enough. So maybe if we add a little decay, so we seek alpha such that LP alpha is in L1. Careful with the word inverse, but yes, it's a dual request. So what I'm going to do, what I'm going to say is this, okay, here's another way to say this. This doesn't look differentiable as a function, as an operator from LP to LP tilde. For one thing, it doesn't end up in LP. The derivative is not in LP tilde. So what I'm going to do is, I will take it as an operator from a smaller space to a larger space than LP tilde. So the smaller space will be LP alpha, the larger space will be LP tilde minus beta. And as an operator from that smaller space to the larger space, it will be differentiable. So here we have F in L1. I want F in L1 if it is in LP alpha. So I write it as F x to the alpha, x to the minus alpha. So this is less than by holder LP alpha times x to the minus alpha p prime. So this is finite if alpha p prime is bigger than 2. Which means alpha is bigger than 2 over p prime. Which, by the way, is also less than 1. And so their theorem is, or lemma, I said proposition, but I erased it, so I may as well call it a lemma. Let alpha be bigger than 2 over p prime, beta bigger than 2 over p tilde, the map k goes to d plus ik inverse is differentiable in the strong, so it's an operator, right? What topology do I put on operators? I put the strong operator topology as operators from LP alpha into LP tilde minus beta. And the derivative is what I said it would be. So at this point, it's actually elementary. Maybe I should use that piece of work. Proof. Let k is k1. So this is going to be a little boring, I'm warning you. On the other hand, it's the sort of thing that nobody ever shows you, so the trade-off is you'll be bored, but on the other hand, I'll be doing your and making your life easier for the future. So I'm going to write k is k1 plus ik2. And the main issue is differentiability. Once I have that it's differentiable in this topology, then it'll be clear that that's the derivative. So what does this mean, that it's differentiable? Well, what it means is d plus ik plus h. So let's take the partial with respect to kk1. So we'll show d dk k1 exists, d dk2 is similar. So d dk k1 is d plus ik plus h inverse minus d plus ik inverse over h. So strong operator topology means there's a D1. I'm going to tell you what D1 is in a moment. We'll find D1 such that this limit as h goes to 0, so h is real here. in LP tilde minus beta equals 0 for F in LP alpha. Okay? That's what we mean. So it converges in the norm of the target space for every fixed F in the, what do you call it, starting space. Oh yeah, D1 will have, in the process it will be clear that D1 is bounded from LP alpha to LP tilde minus beta. No, then I would be claiming that it's continuously differentiable. I didn't say it's continuously differentiable. I just said differentiable. We'll check. I don't know if it is or isn't. Oh. Yes, you caught me. Let's see what D1 looks like before we get too excited. Okay? So what should D1 be? So D plus IK, so this is formal. D plus IK inverse is so F at Z is 1 over pi over there. EK W minus Z over W minus over Z bar minus W bar F of W. And EK is just E to the IKZ plus k bar z bar, which is e to the 2i real part of kz, which is e to the 2i k1 z1 or x1 minus imaginary part of k imaginary part of z. So ddk1 bar ddk1, I'm sorry. ddk1 is 2i let's say w is y1 plus i y2 z let me remind you is x1 plus i x2 so this is 1 minus x1 over z bar minus w bar. With the ek in it. So define this to be d1f at d1f, d1 of k, f at z. Okay, so d1f well, in absolute value, first of all, is less than or equal at z. In absolute value, is less than or equal to y 1 minus x1 over z bar minus w bar is less than or equal to, that's just the x component of that, so it's less than 1, ek is less than one, is equal to one in fact, so we have that. Okay, so in particular, all right, and so d1f l p tilde minus beta, which is less than a constant, the l p tilde minus beta norm is less than a constant, this constant, times the l infinity norm. I'll write down the constant so that you should know what I'm talking about. So it's x to the minus beta p tilde to the 1 over p tilde. Times the d1f l infinity norm, which is less than or equal to a constant. Okay, let's be explicit about it. Beta p tilde to the 1 over p tilde times the L1 norm of f by this trivial inequality, which in turn is less than according to this, x minus alpha p prime times the f lp alpha norm. And note that this is continuous in K by dominated convergence. And K goes to D1K is continuous by dominated convergence. Well, how do we teach undergraduates about continuity? We say fix a k-naught, you want to show that the limit, right, as k goes to k-naught, because of this, you have dominated convergence. So the limit as k goes to k naught of this by dominated convergence equals the integral of the limit. And the limit of ek is ek naught. Ek is continuous. So thanks to you, I will now call this the three dominated convergence lemma, because I'm going to use dominated convergence twice now. I'm running out of space. Okay, so we have D1. D1 is perfectly nicely defined. So now we need to estimate this horribility. But it's not so horrible. Pardon me? No, no, that would be norm topology, which is stronger. The strong operator topology, remember, is weaker than the operator norm. Whom are you talking to? It's for fixed f. So Tn converges to T in the strong operator topology if Tnf minus Tf converges to 0 in the norm. So T goes from one Banach space to another. So this is in Y for all f in X. So this is strong. But it's weaker than operator norm, which says Tn minus T goes to 0. And that's where the soup over the ball in F comes in. All right. So here comes the little messy part. We need to write down this expression. So this expression is, I write it here, d plus I k plus h inverse minus d plus I k inverse over h minus d1 f. So this is equal to one over pi integral E k plus h w minus z minus e k h e k w minus z over z h minus d1, and d1 is 2i y1 minus x1 all that y1 minus x1 Ek W minus Z, right? F of W dW. So let's not do norms yet. And I forgot the Z bar minus W bar part. So this is 1 over pi EH W minus Z minus 1 over H minus 2I Y1 minus X1 times EKW minus Z over Z bar minus W bar F of W DW. Okay, now E to the I don't know what to call it, eta minus 1 over eta by however, what's your favorite way of estimating? So this is a one D parameter. You can use the fundamental theorem of calculus or whatever. So you'll see this is less than Z. So the absolute value of this is less than or equal to 1 over pi. So once plus twice is maybe 3 times here. Z minus W over Z bar minus W bar. EK So that's less than or equal to 3 over pi times the L1 norm of F. Which we've seen is 3 over pi F LP alpha. Times a constant. So, since this is bounded by an L1 function, can apply dominated convergence. So limit as h goes to 0 of d plus I k plus h inverse over h minus d1 f lp tilde minus beta. Is equal to x minus beta. P tilde of that expression to the P tilde dx, the 1 over P tilde, which piece of the ratio, where?
When you copy it,
this, yeah. Minus d plus ik inverse. Thank you. Okay. So this this is equal to that. I don't want to rewrite all that. So replacing by absolute values, this is less than or equal to the integral x minus beta p tilde times in fact the L1 norm of f. Times some constant. And the constant, notice, is independent of h and k. So when you replace it by absolute values, you get a convergent integral. That means you can bring the limit inside. So by dominated convergence, you bring the limit inside. And when you bring the limit inside, we have exactly this. So we need to have the limit as h goes to 0 of that. So that itself is an integral. Right? But if in that integral you put in absolute values, you get something uniformly bounded. And so in this integral, I can also apply dominated convergence. So I'll just say here, apply dominated convergence. So that's why I call it a three dominated convergence lemma. In the inside integral, um, And so you'll have x to the minus beta p tilde integral of limit of that. Limit h goes to 0, ehw minus z minus 1 over h minus 2i y1 minus x1 times dot dot dot. And this is 0 because the exponential is differential. So it's elementary. Okay, so I hope this is enough detail to prove the lemma. We have differentiability. Once you have differentiability, in fact, we proved. This goes to D1, the other one goes to D2, and therefore their sum goes to this, right? D1 plus, this is equal to D1 plus I D2. I won't even say what D2 is, because it's clear. So the sum goes to D1 plus I D2, which is what I'm claiming. Okay. So in the third hour, I'd like to, so we've had enough technical detail, I'd like to, what should I do? Maybe I'll start with a Nuremberg-Walker estimate, make sure it fits in the 1 hour. And the other thing I want to do, if there's time, is to show you the rest of this formal calculation. Right? I've just differentiated this, which is, in fact, the only place k shows up. Now I need to show what happens. How do we get from this lemma to star? Okay, so maybe I'll change the order a bit and first do this. So we figured out the derivative of d plus ik inverse. So now at least formal calculation of dpk bar nk and d mu dk bar. So ddk bar mk, I'm doing this pointwise, so I'm staying away from zero. In particular, I don't want to take d bar of 1 over k. Away from zero, that's analytic, so I can just ignore it. ddk bar of d bar inverse is 0, minus and now we have minus I over pi. So this would be, sorry, this would be mkf at z. Minus I over pi e minus kz. Right? I'm using that formula over there. Times the Fourier transform of dd bar inverse f at k. So this is a calculation that we did last time, but since some of you missed it, let me redo it because it's fun. So the Fourier transform dd bar inverse of dd bar inverse f at k is the usual Fourier transform at the point minus, what is it? Yeah, minus 2kr, 2ki, or k1, k2, did I call it? Doesn't matter. So, dd bar inverse is xc1 minus I xc2, xc1 plus I xc2, f hat of xi. By definition of the Beerling operator. So this is equal to, wherever I see xi1, I put minus 2kr, minus I 2ki, over minus 2kr plus I 2ki. So that's equal to k or minus k over, if we factor an 2i here, No. We just want to factor a minus sign. So it's minus k on top and minus k bar on the bottom. The two cancel. And then the minus signs also cancel. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's different kind of Fourier transforms. I mean, have you been reading your notes? FFK is by definition EKF, EK Z, FZ, DZ. So that's equal to E to the I KZ plus K bar Z bar FZ. So this is E to the I twice the real part, which is K R X1 minus K I X2 F. Whereas the hat is E to the I minus I X dot C F of X dx. So this is F hat at minus 2kr and 2ki. So of course it's the same object, it's just a different notation, but this one happens to be convenient in this problem. And so we get three minus signs, that leaves us with one minus sign, minus I over pi, 4 pi, oops, the I goes away, 4 k, e minus k, 4 pi k, e minus k times k over k bar, FFK. So this is minus 1 over 4 pi k bar e minus k FFK. Where did I anticipate? So first of all, this formula is correct, right?
Okay. Now,
yeah, I'm differentiating this. Okay, so when you differentiate that, you get the Fourier transform of this. And the fun is that this goes away so beautifully. Dr. T? Where is your sign wrong? Right. Here I have three minus signs before the k over k bar. Okay. So may I now erase this board right here? Going once. And so let me at least state the correct differentiation lemma. It's basically what, so this would be the next lemma, lemma 2. If alpha is between 1 and 2 over p prime, and beta is bigger than 2 over p tilde, the map k goes to mk is differentiable on C minus 0 in the strong operator topology from LP alpha to W1 P tilde minus beta. And ddk bar of mk equals of f is minus 1 over 4 pi k bar e minus, so this is at z, e minus kz Fourier transform of f at k. Now, you might say, sure, once we have that lemma, this should just follow immediately. But it doesn't. It takes work. And the reason it doesn't is this thing right here. We're applying D plus IK inverse to D D bar inverse F. Now, what you saw in this, in the proof that we went through in painful detail, is basically you needed F in L1. So when F is in L1, this D plus IK inverse has a perfectly nice derivative. So in lemma 1, let's call it lemma 1 over there. We needed F in L1 somehow. Yet, you might say, don't bother me with that. We're applying mk to q times something, so this might even have compact support, right, in the actual problem we're interested in. Yet, even if f has compact support, dd bar inverse f need not be in L1. So the technical way I got around that is the following lemma 3, which I will let you decide if you'd like to see the proof. It's a new idea. That will be next time. So lemma 3 what it says is the following. You take d d bar inverse of the smaller space LP alpha and you can, so the result will not be integrable, but you can decompose it into something which is integrable. So this piece is okay. And something which is in the space where the derivative is in LP alpha. Now I haven't told you what delta is. So if alpha is less than 1, bigger than 2 over p prime, and alpha plus 1 minus 2 over p So remember we had this problem before when we tried to apply the inverse to something which wasn't decaying enough. We used a resolvent type identity to exploit the fact that even though this, so this is not, so remark, LP delta is not in L1 with our choice of delta. Right, for it to be in L1, delta would have to be bigger than 2 over p prime, and actually it's less. So we are decomposing dd bar inverse of such a function into two functions. One is okay, and we can use the previous result lemma 1 on it, and the other one is not okay, but its derivative is okay. And that's how we get around that particular technicality. Pardon me? Again, using, I didn't tell you that, but using the same idea as the resolvent identity I had when I defined MK. So okay, so think about whether you want to see that next time or not. So that proof consists in essentially seeing how the weights and the derivatives interact. And that's where it helps to have nice explicit weights. All right. So, just to see where things are going, once you prove lemma 3, so this will be used in the proof of lemma 2. Once you prove lemma 3, we are able to turn the formal computation that I had up here into a proof that this is indeed the derivative of Fadeev's Green's function. Remember, MK is basically the Fadeev's Green's function. So let me show you what you do with that once you prove it. So this is preview. So the formal preview of proof of the theorem. Of today's theorem. Exactly. Today's theorem is equation star. Let's see if it's still on the board. Here it is. No, it's not equation star. It's that. More than that. So what I want to do is to use star to get to that. Okay, so what did I accomplish so far? I've told you what DMK DK bar is. So, mu is 1 minus MK Q mu. So D mu DK bar is minus dmk dk bar q mu minus mk q d mu dk bar. So now this is equal to, by lemma 2, I have an expression for DDK bar of MK. So this is equal to plus 1 over 4 pi K bar times the Fourier transform of Q mu at K right, times E minus KZ. So I'm applying this operator to the function Q mu. So it's equal to this times the Fourier transform of Q mu minus MK Q d mu dk bar. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what is the Fourier transform of Q mu? F Q mu is EK Q mu. That's my friend T. So you see, it's not, I'm not inserting T, it comes in. And so d mu dk bar equals 1 over 4 pi k bar t of k e minus kz minus mk q d mu dk bar. So this is a linear integral equation in d mu dk bar. Now, this is just a number. K is fixed right now. This is an equation in X space. Yeah, and K is an operator in X, parameterized by K. So this is just a number. And this is an explicit little function. So let's nu of xk be the solution of nu is e minus k minus mk q nu. Note, since K is not exceptional, not an exceptional point, since by assumption K is not an exceptional point, let's say star star has a unique solution. So comparing to, by uniqueness, comparing to the above, then d mu dk bar equals 1 over 4 pi k bar t of k nu. So that's precisely what's claimed in the theorem. It remains to check. It remains to show that nu is e minus k mu bar. So if I can prove, right, I know how to solve this equation if I put a 1 here. If I can show that if I replace this 1 by the wiggling exponential, the answer is equal to this, then I have my nu, therefore I have my d mu dk bar, which is what the theorem claims. So I don't need this anymore. How do we do that? So I think it's at least at this formal level or semi-formal level, it's easier to work with the differential equation. So we have 4 times d bar d plus I k mu equals q minus q mu, and mu goes to 1 as z goes to infinity. So if I take if I take complex conjugate, this is d bar minus I k bar mu bar is minus q mu bar. So very important, I use the fact here since q is real valued. Otherwise, this formula is wrong. If q is not real valued, by the way, this puts us from the sheet with zeta equal kik to the sheet with k bar minus ik bar, which we've been ignoring. Okay, so let's just see what equation does E minus K mu bar satisfy. So write mu bar as E K nu. Or, you know, I should call it something else, so you shouldn't think I'm cheating. Nu tilde. Okay? Then d bar minus I k bar mu bar is d bar nu bar d bar of this is plus I k bar minus I k bar of nu tilde. So that's just the product rule. So that's ek d bar nu tilde. Don't confuse the tildes and the bars. And so d of d bar minus I k bar mu bar is d plus ik d bar nu tilde. Times ek. Just take d of this. Yes? D of EK D bar is D D bar plus D EK D bar, and D EK is IK. And that's what I'm saying. But this is equal to, so 4 times this equals 4 times that. 4 times this is minus q mu bar, which is equal to minus Q Ek nu tilde. Okay, so what's the logic? I start with mu. Mu is the function I constructed a while ago, good and solid. Mu satisfies this, therefore mu bar satisfies that. I make a little change. I define nu tilde to be E minus K mu bar. So I.e. define nu tilde is E minus K mu bar. Then, what this shows is D plus IK D bar nu tilde is minus Q nu tilde. From here and there, you can cancel the EK. Furthermore, nu tilde minus E minus K, right, is E minus K nu bar minus 1, and that's in LP tilde. If you wish, intersect L infinity. So what do we know? We know there's a unique solution, and this and Q is in LP, because mu is bounded and Q is in LP. So this is the operator we studied in great detail, for which MK is the inverse. And we know if the right side is in LP, there's a unique answer in LP tilde. Therefore, nu tilde equals, nu tilde minus E minus K is MK of, yakity yak. It's minus MK of Q nu tilde. So nu tilde satisfies the same equation as nu, since there's a unique solution. We conclude over here, we conclude nu equals nu tilde, which by definition was what I want it to be, E minus K mu bar. Okay, so as advertised, I was able to explicitly solve for you this integral equation in terms of mu. And since when taking d bar, this expression as a function of x is very simple, it's just that, we are able to explicitly have the formula claimed in the theorem. Okay, so how many people want to see the proof of the lemma next time? Okay. Sorry about the rest of you who couldn't care less, but or maybe are just brilliant and can just do it in your head as you're staring at it. Okay, so I'll do that. But that relies on the Nirenberg-Walker estimates. Those are estimates for not just D bar inverse, but I'll only do it for D bar inverse, but they're estimates for general elliptic PDEs, inverses of a general elliptic PDEs, and they have general interest. So, I mean, they weren't thinking about this problem. It's been applied in relativity and so forth. So it's a basic weighted LP estimate for, if you wish, Green's functions. Okay, thank you so much and see you in 1 week.